Time I would be giving the latest in health and healing, but because it's a holiday, not a lot of people are listening, I thought, well, I'll save that for tomorrow. But I put together a program that I believe you're going to find very interesting. It's for the deeper thinkers, the more critical thinkers in our audience, and I'm going to play you three clips. The first clip I'm going to play you is about a Dr. Peter Hotez, H-O-T-E-Z, and his dark past. This is from Redacted with Natalie and Clayton Morris. And they do a good show. I don't agree with them on all things. But on this one, I believe that they should be paid attention to. Why? Because there were several major spokespersons. Dr. Walensky, the CDC, Anthony Fauci, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, and Dr. Peter Hotez. Hotez is an MD, PhD, and he makes a lot of money, a very good living, from his work on vaccines. Needless to say, he was out there constantly telling us, first it was one vaccine, then when that didn't work, two vaccines, that didn't work, three vaccines, then four vaccines, then vaccines on a regular basis. What I did not hear him saying was, let's look at the independent science to see whether or not we should be putting a never-before-tested biological agent into human beings. This is not technically a vaccine. Vaccines work differently. Rather, this actually creates a spike protein that your cells then manufacture, then your body produces antibodies against them. But it's in your shoulder, it stays in the deltoid muscle, it's gone in, you know, several days, maximum 4 days to a week, and it's safe and effective. Okay, but everything that you were believing simply turned out to be wrong. So if a person is that educated, is that interconnected with the loop of all the, you know, scientific minds around the world and governmental agencies, couldn't he have found the truth? Well, there seems to be another part of the story, and now Peter Hotez has been challenged. Robert Kennedy is saying, let's debate. You know, debate. It'll be civil, but you're accusing me of things that are not true based upon my challenging the COVID vaccine. Hotez won't debate him. He says that science is not about debate. To the contrary, as a scientist for 38 years of my life in a laboratory, I can tell you that all of science is open to debate and discussion, and hopefully in a civil manner, not always, but at least this is how you challenge something to see whether or not it benefits from close scrutiny. And of course, the moment someone says, well, the consensus says, like this week, there was a newspaper, syndicated newspaper, that says, you know, Hotez doesn't have to answer, shouldn't debate, the science is settled. No, the science is not settled. Every single day we've been bringing you stories that show you why it's just now becoming realistic that the people who got vaccinated are most at risk of developing COVID or its variants, and going to hospital and dying. Plus, all these other horrible things are increasing, the increased risk of miscarriages and stillbirths, of myocarditis and embolisms. All of these are increasing in younger people at an astronomical level, and we have lots of studies proving this. Also, they've reduced, redacted, or eliminated 300 studies in the last 12 months. These are people supporting COVID and supportive of the narrative, and they don't want to be caught on the wrong side of this issue. So what they did, they simply got rid of the articles, as if somehow the internet is not capable of finding everything you've ever written, which we are. So here is Redacted, showing the dark side of Peter Hotez and why we believe he should debate, because if he did, Robert Kennedy would just show that he is wrong on everything he's been promoting.
Well, it looks like we're watching the self-destruction of Dr. Peter Hotez, who continues to publicly defend his decision to not go on Joe Rogan and have any kind of debate over his position on COVID vaccines, his involvement in gain-of-function research, and all of it. All of it. And the mainstream media seems hell-bent on doing everything it can to defend Dr. Peter Hotez. It's almost as if there's money involved somehow. Well, we don't know. Dan Cohen has been tracking this story before anyone else was covering this story many, many months ago for Redacted, and is watching this sort of self-implosion happen in real time. Dan, what's the latest on this story?
Well, Clayton, like you said, the media is completely coming to the defense of Peter Hotez, who has refused to defend his positions on the Joe Rogan podcast, which he has appeared on before and had a friendly platform and multiple times. So it's a total about face, a total reversal from his previous position. And if you look at his statements, the statements that Peter Hotez made in 2020, where he explicitly said that it's important for scientists to go on television channels and appear in the media to defend so-called science. Well, it's a total, he's made a complete reversal. So look at this. He says in 2020, in his article called Combating Anti-Science, he says, "It is now increasingly apparent that it will fall to the scientists themselves to respond, engage a skeptical public, and lead the defense of science." Okay, in May 2020, right around the same time, he says, "The communications and missteps around the rollout of COVID-19 vaccines may require a period of damage control." He's, of course, referring to the constant flip-flopping. For example, when he said that emergency use authorization should not be used and that it's dangerous. And then, of course, he knew that later, when it was time, when Trump was going to be out of office and Biden would be the president, then he was going to completely reverse. And he carries on and says, "It will be essential for the White House, together with the NIH and other elements of our science infrastructure, to shape a well-crafted vaccine communication plan that must also designate a trusted spokesperson who can articulate and carry the message." So for his strategy, it's very important to be out front. And that's why we've seen Peter Hotez on corporate media, on MSNBC, CNN, Fox, Bloomberg, all of them constantly for the past 3 years. Only when he gets a friendly platform where he's just going to be treated like some kind of genius who's unquestionable, no matter how many times he contradicts himself or outright lies. So now that he's been exposed and we see his total hypocrisy from his previous statements on why scientists should be in the media, the mainstream media has come once again to his defense. So we have the BBC, we have the Washington Post, whose their op-ed says Joe Rogan wants a debate on vaccines. That's just the problem. Okay, we have Time Magazine says Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is dead wrong about vaccines. That's the op-ed from Time, which, I mean, if he's dead wrong, it sounds like it would be really easy to debunk what to discredit RFK Jr., who is rising in the polls. So these guys obviously don't want to do that. But there is a very friendly relationship between not only Peter Hotez and these media outlets, but Peter Hotez's sugar daddy, his paymaster, none other than Bill Gates. There's a very friendly relationship and financial relationship between Hotez and Bill Gates, and also between Bill Gates and these very media outlets. The BBC has taken millions of dollars from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So that certainly would shape their interest. Time Magazine, that article was written by Gavin Yamey, who works at Duke University's Center for Policy, Impact, and Global Health. Now, Duke University is funded heavily by the Gates Foundation to the tune of $10.6 million, and the Center for Policy Impact's website explicitly says it is funded by the Gates Foundation, among others. There's another article from Bloomberg, authored by Tyler Cowen, saying, if Joe Rogan asks you to debate, be suspicious. Bloomberg, of course, owned by Michael Bloomberg, the billionaire, has a close relationship with Gates. Gates Foundation has even given money to Bloomberg's foundation. So all of these op-eds, there is a sort of financial and ideological weaving and relationship that, of course, is not disclosed. So it's, again, you just see this very top-heavy apparatus coming to the defense of Peter Hotez as he's, as you described, self-imploding, embarrassing himself on a national stage where he had a completely neutral platform and has decided to flush that away because he knows he can't defend his positions against anyone who has, like RFK, who knows what he has said and what he's done and has looked into a lot of the actual science behind these pharmaceutical products, or to anyone who's even a redacted watcher who watched our investigations from January that exposed Hotez as a fraud.
Yeah, and it's not even just the vaccine part of it, right? Because you can have a debate about the vaccine efficacy. We now know the new documents that came out from a Freedom of Information Act request, of course, on vaccine mandates and how those vaccine mandates, how they were precipiced, which was basically on a foundations of a lie. But even beyond that, his involvement at NIH, his involvement going back many, many years to gain-of-function research, like that to me seems to me what they're trying to hide here, or they're trying to do their best to keep him shielded, right? So talk a little bit about that, his history in this, because the vaccine and discussions about the vaccine, that's one thing. We can look at all the data now that's come out on this, but his involvement in this and how he received money and how dirty he is, that's really what they're worried about, I think.
Well, his entire career has been funded by not only by Bill Gates, but by Anthony Fauci, who's taken huge amounts of money from, you know, as we exposed in January in our redacted investigations, that the NIH under Fauci has given millions and millions of dollars to Peter Hotez. And Peter Hotez completely denies that he's funded by Big Pharma or tied to Big Pharma. He's been funded by Pfizer since the very beginning, since he came out of school. When he became a PhD, his first fellowship was funded by Pfizer. He had another Pfizer fellowship in 2003 at Stony Brook University in New York. He still maintains close relationships with Pfizer. I've shown that before, that I think they wine and dine him is what it apparently is. And so he is completely part of Big Pharma, biosecurity complex. And so you're right, it's more than just the vaccines. It's everything that this guy represents. He is the biosecurity complex personified. That's what Peter Hotez is. And so anyone who has an open mind like Rogan, or anyone who's more informed like RFK, he cannot handle that kind of debate. So he would just be instantly exposed. I mean, do you remember the clip where Rogan said, do you exercise? Do you eat well? Peter Hotez melted down. He couldn't even handle that question. He embarrassed himself and looked like a goon. And that probably has done more damage to him than our investigation. I don't know. Just the fact that Rogan asked him that question, it just embarrassed him.
And it's just a simple question. Are you healthy? Do you eat healthy? And he's just, it was not a good answer. It was not a good answer. Joe Rogan, you have the Vox piece too. And it's amazing when you have, Hotez loves to retweet these articles over the past 48 hours. He's been like, sort of any article that's favorable to him, telling him not to have a debate, he's been out there retweeting these things, as you pointed out in some of these messages. But one of my favorites is this Vox media piece. So from Vox.com, Joe Rogan wants a debate on vaccine science. Don't give it to him, reads the headline from Vox. What? Don't give it to him? because it's really personal. It's only going to be him in a room. No one else is going to be listening. The millions of people that listen to this, it's only going to be him that's going to hear it, I guess.
Exactly. They cannot handle any kind of questioning and any kind of debate. And I think, Clayton, I think the really important thing to understand about Peter Hotez is not, and what he represents, really, is not just that he won't have a debate and that he's an intellectual coward and fraud, is that he actually wants to criminalize people who ask questions about vaccines and pharmaceutical products. So he has explicitly said that he wants the U.S. government, the World Health Organization, NATO, the United Nations, to treat so-called anti-science aggression, meaning, you know, any parent who thinks, well, do I want to put this syringe full of some product I don't know anything about into my child's leg, into my infant's leg? I don't know. That person, according to Peter Hotez, should be treated as a terrorist. He literally calls them terrorists. So what does that mean? I mean, does that mean, you know, they should be censored? Does that mean they should be imprisoned? Does that mean, I don't know, we should have the CIA's drones go and like launch strikes on them, because that's what we do with terrorists? That's what, you know, we do with alleged terrorists in the United States, anywhere they are in the world. So, I mean, you get a sense.
Well, this reminds me of Jimmy Kimmel. Remember when Jimmy Kimmel, sort of that same sentiment, Jimmy Kimmel during the pandemic, the quote unquote pandemic, when he said, you know, if you die, well, that's on you then.
Unvaccinated guy who gobbled horse goo, rest in peace, Wheezy.
Thinning out the herd, natural selection to his mind, right? Are you too stupid to get vaccinated? Therefore, you should die if you don't get vaccinated.
Exactly. And anyone who doesn't go along with this, who doesn't take their own health into their own hands, you know, do their own research, consider, I mean, that's what medicine always was, you know, traditionally has been, is your doctor consults you and helps you make a decision, not tries to force you to do what they say under threat of censorship or arrest or anything else. But in this kind of, you know, strange new world of medicine, Peter Hotez is the kind of, you know, really embodies the logic and the ethos of, you know, take the injection and shut up, and if you don't want to, then it's your fault if you die, and that's all it is.
Unbelievable. Well, we continue to watch Dr. Peter Hotez. Maybe, you know, if he doesn't want to debate RFK Jr., you know, there's others that have stepped forward, cardiologist Dr. Peter McCullough, who've said, I'll be happy to sit down and do a debate with him. Been on the show before, and if you want a scientist, here we go. Here we go. We'll have a debate there. I would love to see it. I want to have a good discussion. I don't care if it's RFK Jr. or somebody else. Dan Cohen, thank you for this. Thank you for the updates on Dr. Peter Hotez, man who was out in front on this story many, many months before everyone else. Dan, great to see you.
Now, that's our first clip, but now we're going to go to a different clip. And this one is about how do we get to a state where our entire scientific community, much of our medical community, virtually all of our media community and government agencies and corporate leaders are all supporting woke philosophies where it's equity instead of equality. We all, reasonable people, I should say, believe we should have equal opportunity. No one should be told, no, you can't because of the color of your skin, your religious belief, your age. We should give people a chance. And I'm firmly a supporter of giving people a chance. But they don't want that. They want to exclude anyone who they disagree with. And how did we get here? Well, two of the smartest people that I know, Douglas Murray and Professor Peter Boghossian, are having a conversation on woke ideology. It's about an hour long. We're only going to play 19 minutes, but I think this will allow us to understand why everything that we're being taught should be challenged for accuracy and objectivity, because we're going to find it's almost always wrong, just the opposite. Okay? And they're very powerful. They're a minority within the population, but the silent majority is sick of it, sick of all this wokeism and critical race theory and identity politics. Let's go now to this conversation on woke ideology.
So in the university system, you have math, you have whatever the subject areas may happen to be, you have philosophy, but then you also have a parallel architecture that's been set up in which insert word studies is set up, gender studies. And so gender studies isn't merely the study of gender, it's the study of gender. And these fields, and that's really among the most generous thing one could say about them, these fields operate by their own rules. They have their own methodologies. They have their own ways that they advance. So, for example, one thing that they use is lived experience. Mm. In the literature, it's called standpoint epistemology. So we all have our own lived experience, and we need to, a word they're very fond of, privilege certain sorts of life experiences. So I can never, as a cis white heterosexual male, experience or have access to the lived experience of somebody has more oppression variables than I have. Mm. So to understand that, we need a field of study, critical race theory, critical studies, which is just, it's interesting, by the way, at Portland State University, there was an event in which white people could attend but couldn't ask questions. So it was a listening event.
What could possibly go wrong with telling people to shut up based on their skin color?
First of all, I was amazed that was legal at a public institution. So a long story short, I found out that it was legal, but it was inadvisable because if you do that, then you could create another event for white people where black people could attend, but they weren't allowed to speak.
One of the most interesting things about this attempt to section off people according to group characteristics, first of all, is that it makes a claim which is self-contradictory on its own terms. It says simultaneously, a group of people cannot understand another group of people because they have not had the same lived experience. And it simultaneously says, but you must devote your life to trying to do so.
Right.
It's what I've described as the, you must understand me, you will never understand me conundrum. But the moral evil, it seems to me, underneath it is this, is that if I cannot understand somebody who's black and somebody who's Asian cannot understand me, and I can't understand a straight person and a straight person can't understand me, and on, and none of us who are male can understand women, and so on, then it's unclear how we should aspire to communicate in our lives.
Yeah.
And it's unclear why we would bother to read or talk or think across lines. It says we must be stuck in our silo. Mm. I must only read gay, white, male literature, because although I could try to read literature by other people, it's really not worth it because I'll never understand it. That suggests that we as human beings can never get beyond whatever trait we're born with. It's profoundly anti-human.
And we know that that's false for a number of reasons. For example, you're gay and I'm straight, but we both know what love is. We both feel love.
And I think there's nothing that either of us cannot understand about the other or their point of view.
Right.
I don't think there's anything you could say that I would say, I can't wrap my head around that because I'm gay.
Right.
And I don't think there's anything I would say that you'd say, I just can't understand what Douglas is talking about, but it must be because I'm straight. It's such, on its own terms, a ludicrous and
poisonous. It poisons interactions. But we also know that that's false because we do it all the time. We construct institutions. We go to the bank and make change.
Yeah.
We put in our order for lunch today.
Yes.
We don't know the gender or the sexual orientation of the person who took our lunch. So we certainly we do it with commerce, but we do it with commerce in the broadest sense when we create systems to do these things.
Yes. And it also, of course, it among other things, makes us retreat into the following problem, which is that if we can't understand each other, it's unclear how we could sort out any problems.
Right.
Other than through violence.
Right.
Because if either we can communicate successfully with each other as human beings, or communication is in some way impossible because understanding is impossible, and then what do we have other than violence?
Right.
Now, the thing that they claim to be wanting to avert is precisely the thing that they're most likely to encourage.
Right. And when you think about that, well, what if someone is gay and black? Well, then Right. So there are ever divisions in which you can only communicate more narrowly with people and who share.
Yes. And all of these things, because, as you know, the intersectionalists are fascinated by this, aren't they? Right. They think there's nothing so interesting as finding interlocking oppressions and so on. And this in the identity politics and intersectionalist game is almost the heart of the game, because of the assertion that is made that all oppression in human existence is interweaved, that it is all interlocked, and that if you were to address one form of oppression, you would have to address the others. So the intersectionalists say it's not good enough to address remaining misogyny in society without addressing remaining misogyny in relation to black women in society. And then it's not sufficient to address remaining misogyny against black women in society. You must fixate on black trans women in society, and on and on and on. Some of which is interesting, some of which, but it's a long way away from solving any problems, because among much else, it says this is so completely interlocked that to unweave it, to unlock it, you would solve something. And my suggestion is you can't, because all of these things are more complex even on those terms. For instance, what do you do with somebody who has some of those characteristics but ducks out from another aspect of it? What do you do about a black woman for whom their femininity is very important to them, but they don't have any interest in black issues? Or they identify as a black person, they'd rather not be reduced to being, you know, a woman. And on and on and on along this way you go. And it seems to me that it's obvious that the intersections don't all resolve and find resolution. They madden people because there are all these tensions which are going to exist anyway.
Imagine taking that upon yourself and thinking that if you think this way, you are a better person. That, to me, is what is particularly maddening. It's the move from thinking about something to feeling it makes you a better person if you have this worldview. If you're constantly looking at people. So when you walk into a store and there's a mixed race couple, that has to command a certain percentage of your attention.
To steel man what they think they're doing, they think that they're correcting injustices that have existed in the past by overcorrecting in the present. So they think that because it's undoubtedly true that women have not always historically been able to achieve what they should have been able to achieve by dint of being a woman, because homosexuality was criminalized until the 60s, because this country in America, like many other countries in the world, had terrible racial problems throughout a significant portion of its history, which were not resolved until, you'd argue, the latter part of the 20th century, and some people think still not. But it suggests that because of that historic injustice, it must be rectified now by doing it the other way around, at least for a period of time.
That's equity.
Equity. So because women undoubtedly didn't always have the opportunities they should have had, we'll make up for it by insulting men now.
Right.
You can do the same thing on the LGBT bit, but the most obvious one, the most really rancid and divisive one now, is black people undoubtedly had oppression in the past, so we'll make white people feel like the bad ones. And I think they think, this is steel manning and attributing good motive to it, I think they think they'll only need to do it for a time. The problem is,
the work is never done.
The work is never done. They don't know when they'd stop.
Right.
They don't know who would call time. And the crucial thing is, they don't know when the overcorrection doesn't end up swinging the other way. Like, you know, the question I always wonder on about this is it wise for the portion of feminist studies that decided that the best way to advance women is to insult men, do they think long-term it's a good strategy to try to demoralize 50% of the population? It seemed to me unwise and a hard way to get support long-term.
If the goal is to reach some kind of a consensus.
If it's to reach a consensus. And the same, obviously, with racial issues. If you agree that because black people in history have been disadvantaged, is it wise, particularly in a country like America, where the black population is, what, 13% of the population, is it wise to talk about the group that is the majority group still, white people, as if they are guilty beings who carry historic sin and can never be redeemed? It seems to me that if that is the plan in the overcorrection, I can see quite a lot of ways in which that goes wrong.
Right.
When I first started looking at identity politics, intersectionalism, and all that sort of thing, I knew that I should try to engage with the fundamental texts. What were the foundational texts? And one of the ones I heard about a lot, it's one of the most cited texts, is Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack.
Yeah.
And I thought when I got this text, I thought, well, there must be something there. It'll be something to contend with. And no, it's a few pages of assertions made by this academic, many of which are erroneous, many of which are false, provably so. And yet this is one of the most cited texts, as if what it says is true. And the problem with that is you set up then this hierarchy fight. And the hierarchy fight involves people having to try to work out where they stand in a privilege structure.
Right.
All of which is unsolvable because nobody can do it with one person throughout their life. Nobody can do it with everybody from one class of person throughout their life because people don't fall out like that and aren't able to be summed up like that. And you couldn't even do it hour by hour because it could change. I mean, you could have somebody who appeared to be at the very top of the hierarchy privilege pyramid who turned out, for instance, to have very serious mental problems. And you didn't know that at 12 o'clock, and at 1 o'clock you find it out, and therefore you've got to move them around in the hierarchy of oppression. Nobody worked this out because it can't be worked out.
What a weight. Like, seriously, what a weight to place upon someone as they walk through life to try to figure out what the oppression hierarchy is or the privilege hierarchy.
Yes.
I mean, just imagine, like, you're trying to navigate your life anyway, and then you superimpose on top of that an additional structure of grievance.
Yes. Which also, this, and grievance is obviously the key word here, isn't it? Because to teach somebody that they should feel grievance is, in my view, a quite wicked thing to do.
Right.
Because we all, in our lives, could have grievances. I mean, most of us do have some grievances, and it's not always been seen as a good thing to have.
Right.
It thwarts you in lots of ways.
Right, right.
So to be encouraged to have grievances is to set somebody off from the beginning of their life in a direction which is highly likely to lead them to unhappiness. I mean, I would say that although there are legitimate grievances that people have, they should also be encouraged to try to reconcile themselves with the world, to harmonize themselves with the world, to recognize the things you can do things about and the things that you can't.
The serenity prayer.
Yes, absolutely. And this, the reason why this, that particular bit of wisdom goes across all world traditions is because it's a fundamental insight that in the same way as we know that if we see somebody on an average day and they ask how we are, we tend to say, great or fine. We don't say, actually, my bowels are playing up today and I've got verruca's back and so on. Because not just because they may not want to know the detail, but because we intuit that to do so in some way would make their day worse. It would not only be a selfish thing to do, it would be to spread around grievance in a world which already has a lot of unhappiness and which you don't need to add to. And this is one of the fundamental things, it seems to me, that's so wicked about this project. To encourage people to be more at odds with the world than we all already are is a fundamental moral error.
I think part of the problem with having a conversation with the end goal is that the work is never done. Part of the problem is also you can't identify the end goal because any disparity in outcome is just assumed to be racist. That's the de facto. It's if there is a disparity in outcome, race has to be at the, but not in everything, not in, for example, people who collect garbage or people who have higher risks of death, truckers or something, or on death row, which is almost exclusively male. So I think that the...
Yes, nobody says we need more female representation on death row.
That's correct. That's correct. So I think that the key here is, what does it mean to have an equitable system as opposed to what it means to have a system in which we treat people equally?
Yes. Yeah. This is the absolute heart of the issue, isn't it? I mean, we could get... I don't sound panglossian, but we could get almost total agreement, it seems to me, in American society on the idea that people should have an equal shot in their lives. I think that's a pretty good aspiration.
Right, and I'll give them what they're looking for. And this is where I think many conservatives have fallen. The idea that we can and should just pick ourselves up by our own bootstraps, that's a good idea. But it's far easier to do that if we have systems based upon fairness. For example, it's far easier to do that if everyone has a public education of the first rate, a la John Rawls. So the more there's a disparity in those starting conditions, and I would argue that it's primarily economic, which breaks down as a race as a proxy to that economic conditions. The solution to me seems to be fairness.
Mm. Mm. The
equality of opportunity, yes, as opposed to equality of outcome. That's what they're looking for. They're looking for equity. They want to advance equity, particularly the readjustment of shares as one's previous, quote-unquote, racial history factors into it.
Yes, so long as it's always in a beneficial light. I mean, this is... We are so confused as a society now on all of this, aren't we? I mean, we are so confused. Most people, I think, would hear the words equality and equity as synonyms.
Right.
I think...
Joe Biden, in fact, in the debate,
right,
didn't know the meanings of those terms.
I think it's really troubling when very, very important distinctions are so little understood. Do we want an equal society? Yes, in many ways. Do we want a society where every profession has exactly the correct representation within it, depending on racial and other character traits of the general population, so that if you have less than 13% of the workforce in any sector of the economy, you've got to...
Right. We'd need some governing body to mandate that, and that would separate people from their own proclivities and interests.
Yes. It means that if you didn't have exactly 13% of black employees,
right,
you would have to make sure you fired some employees of other races and put some black people in. It would also, of course, and this is the element that nobody ever wants to focus on, it would mean that if you had 19% of black employees in your firm, you'd have to get rid of some people who were black because they were black, because otherwise the whole racial quota system didn't work, which, of course, opens up the same thing which is highlighted by the lack of female engineers, the lack of female firefighters, and much more, which is you probably can't do that unless... It seemed to be in an area which it's desirable to be in by society at this moment, including highly remunerated jobs, high prestige jobs, and much more. That's, by the way, one of the reasons why every time that the equity discussion comes up and it's around the media or Hollywood, I just put my head in my hands, because I just think that these are the least typical professions imaginable and very bad places to play what remaining equality issues there are in society out, because almost nothing can be played at that level.
It seems to be a bizarre way to just think about things in the first place.
I think we should try to find problems that we could agree on and could solve. That's my view. For instance, I think we could agree on the following proposition across right and left, such as those boundaries exist. We could agree that, for instance, nobody in their lives should be held back from attaining a position they should or could attain, simply held back because of characteristics over which they have no say.
And then here is the best. I'm saving this for last. Let's say that you were a person who believed that the government was right, that we should get our vaccines to protect each other, our family members, we should be quarantined, that this is based upon good and irrefutable science. You got your PCR test at 41 repetitions, and yet the science, based upon the person who won the Nobel Prize in chemistry, Dr. Carey Mullis, who is a professional friend of mine. In fact, go up on the internet, go up on my channel, GaryNoel.com, and look under my interview with Professor Carey Mullis. And that was in 1996, and he was challenging Anthony Fauci and all the mistakes Fauci was making back then, and Fauci wouldn't debate him. Nobody would debate him because he knew what he was talking about. He said, do not get a test for PCR as if it's a diagnostic tool. It's not. It has a lot of good purposes, but it's just amplifying what's in your cell. But when you amplify more than, he said, 13 to 16 amplifications, you're just seeing garbage, debris. And how many amplifications did all of you have? 40 to 44. Well, that's garbage. That means we created a pandemic of false numbers based on a false test. And if you took away all those false numbers and people were, I'm positive, are you? How do you know? You don't have any symptoms. Well, but I'm testing that I should be positive. And then look at what we put people through. So now comes a person who's got a handle on it that no one else has. This is Dr. David Martin. Now, you got to understand, he's speaking before the European Parliament. And you will see that until recently, until 6 months ago, none of the critics of the COVID protocols would have been allowed to speak at the European Parliament. But then one day, the European Parliament was having a perfunctory meeting with some of the presidents of Pfizer's divisions, and a person just asked a simple question. Talk about the test that you did for the vaccine that showed that if you got the vaccine, that you wouldn't spread the virus to other people. And this woman said, we never did that test. And the place was silent. So he repeated, he says, well, hold on. You know, surely you have a test or test that showed that if you got the vaccine, you wouldn't spread it. That was the whole purpose of isolation, not allowing people to fly unless they're vaccinated, not allowing them in restaurants, not allowing, on boats, in public places. We created a vaccine apartheid around the world, really bad in Canada, in Australia, New Zealand, and the United States. No, we never did the test. Now think of that for a moment. Think of Rachel Maddow. Think of President of the United States. Think of Peter Hotez. Think of Walensky. Think of all the people, including Anthony Fauci, says, if you get your vaccines, you won't infect other people, you won't be infected, you won't go to the hospital, and you won't die. None of that was true. So then, if all these best and brightest minds with unlimited money and resources, what could this all have been about? David Martin testifying before the European Union answers that question. Now, to Dr. David Martin. And notice at the end, he's given a standing ovation.
It is a particularly interesting location for me to be sitting today, given that over a decade ago, I sat in this very chair right here in the European Union Parliament. And at that time, I warned the world of what was coming. During that conversation that was hosted at the time by the Green and EFA and a number of the other parties of the European Union's various representations, we were having a conversation on whether Europe should adopt the United States policy of allowing for the patents on biologically derived materials. And at the time, I urged this body and I urged people around the world that the weaponization of nature against humanity had dire consequences. Tragically, I sit here today with that unfortunate line that I don't like to say, which I told you so. But the fact of the matter is, we're here not for a reprisal on past decisions. We're here to actually, once again, come to the face of the human condition and ask the question, who do we want to be? What do we want humanity to look like? And rather than seeing this as an exercise in futility, which is very easy from time to time when you're in the position I'm in, I actually see this not as an exercise in futility. I see this as one of the greatest opportunities that faces us, because we now have a public conversation, which is now front and center in people's minds. When this was an esoteric conversation about biological patents, nobody cared. But when that conversation came home, then it became something people can care about. So I'm actually quite grateful for this opportunity. I thank the members of Parliament for hosting this. I thank all of the translators who, I apologize in advance, I will use terminology that is probably very difficult to translate, so my apologies. And I'd also like to acknowledge the fact that many of you are aware of my involvement with this, in large part due to the amazing work of my wonderful wife, Kim Martin, who encouraged me at the very early days of this pandemic to get on front of the camera and talk about all the information that I had been sharing among very small groups around the world. And it was, in fact, her encouragement that put me in a place where many of you have heard what I have to say. Ironically, the world that I came from, that used to be very popular, my CNBC and Bloomberg presentations, which were televised on mainstream media around the world, was an audience that I lost. I can confidently say COVID diminished my fame. But I can also confidently say that I'd rather stand among the people with whom I'm standing today than any of the folks that were part of that previous world. So this is a much better place to be. My role today is to set the stage for this conversation in a historical context, because this did not come in the last 3 years. This did not come in the last 5 or 6 years. This actually is an ongoing question that probably began here in Europe in the early stages of the mid-1900s, but certainly by 1913, 1914, this conversation started right here in Central Europe. The pandemic that we alleged to have happened in the last few years also did not happen overnight. In fact, the very specific pandemic using coronavirus began in a very different time. And we'll try to advance the slides here with one of these things. Oh, there we go. Most of you don't know that coronavirus as a model of a pathogen was isolated in 1965. Coronavirus was identified in 1965 as one of the first infectious replicatable viral models that could be used to modify a series of other experiences of the human condition. It was isolated once upon a time associated with the common cold. But what's particularly interesting about its isolation in 1965 was that it was immediately identified as a pathogen that could be used and modified for a whole host of reasons. And you heard me correctly, that was 1965. And by the way, these slides are public domain. You're welcome to look at every single reference. Every comment that I made is based on published material. So do make sure that you look at those references. But in 1966, the very first COV coronavirus model was used as a transatlantic biological experiment in human manipulation. And you heard the date, 1966. I hope you're getting the point of what I'm saying. This is not an overnight thing. This is actually something that's been long in the making. A year before I was born, we had the first transatlantic coronavirus data sharing experiment between the United States and the United Kingdom. And in 1967, the year I was born, we did the first human trials on inoculating people with modified coronavirus. Isn't that amazing? 56 years ago, the overnight success of a pathogen that's been 56 years in engineering. And I want that to chill with all of you. Where were we when we actually allowed, in violation of biological and chemical weapons treaties, where were we as a human civilization when we thought it was an acceptable thing to do to take a pathogen for the United States and infect the world with it? Where was that conversation? And what should have been that conversation in 1967? That conversation wasn't had. Ironically, the common cold was turned into a chimera in the 1970s. And in 1975, 1976, and 1977, we started figuring out how to modify coronavirus by putting it into different animals, pigs and dogs. And not surprisingly, by the time we got to 1990, we found out that coronavirus as an infectious agent was an industrial problem for two primary industries, the industries of dogs and pigs. Dog breeders and pigs found that coronavirus created gastrointestinal problems, and that became the basis for Pfizer's first spike protein vaccine patent filed, are you ready for this, in 1990. Did you hear what I just said? 1990. Operation Warp Speed? I'm sorry. Where's the warp and the speed? Pfizer, 1990, the very first spike protein vaccine for coronavirus. Isn't that fascinating? Isn't it fascinating that we were told that, well, the spike protein is a new thing. We just found out that that's the problem. No. As a matter of fact, we didn't just find out it was not just now the problem. We found that out in 1990 and filed the first patents on vaccines in 1990 for the spike protein of coronavirus. And who would have thought? Pfizer. Clearly the innocent organization that does nothing but promote human health. Clearly Pfizer. The organization that has not bought the votes in this chamber and in every chamber of every government around the world. Not that Pfizer. Certainly, they wouldn't have had anything to do with this. But oh yes, they did. And in 1990, they found out that there was a problem with vaccines. They didn't work. You know why they didn't work? It turns out that coronavirus is a very malleable model. It transforms and it changes and it mutates over time. As a matter of fact, every publication on vaccines for coronavirus from 1990 until 2018, every single publication concluded that coronavirus escapes the vaccine impulse because it modifies and mutates too quickly for vaccines to be effective. And since 1990 to 2018, that is the published science, ladies and gentlemen. That's following the science. Following the science is their own indictment of their own programs that said it doesn't work. And there are thousands of publications to that effect, not a few hundred. And not paid for by pharmaceutical companies. These are publications that are independent scientific research that shows unequivocally, including efforts of the chimera modifications made by Ralph Baer in the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. All of them show vaccines do not work on coronavirus. That's the science. And that science has never been disputed. But then we had an interesting development in 2002. And this date is most important. Because in 2002, the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, patented, and I quote, an infectious replication defective clone of coronavirus. Listen to those words, infectious replication defective. What does that phrase actually mean? For those of you not familiar with language, let me unpack it for you. Infectious replication defective means a weapon. It means something meant to target an individual, but not have collateral damage to other individuals. That's what infectious replication defective means. And that patent was filed in 2002 on work funded by NIAID's Anthony Fauci from 1999 to 2002. And that work, patented at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, mysteriously preceded SARS 1.0 by a year. Dave, are you suggesting that SARS 1.0 wasn't from a wet market in Wuhan? Are you suggesting it might have come from a laboratory in the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill? No, I'm not suggesting it. I'm telling you that's the facts. We engineered SARS. SARS is not a naturally occurring phenomenon. The naturally occurring phenomenon is called the common cold. It's called influenza-like illness. It's called gastroenteritis. That's the naturally occurring coronavirus. SARS is the research developed by humans weaponizing a life system model to actually attack human beings. And they patented it in 2002. And in 2003, giant surprise, the CDC filed the patent on coronavirus isolated from humans in violation, once again, of biological and chemical weapons treaties and laws that we have in the United States. And I'm very, very precise on this. The United States likes to talk about its rights and everything else and the rule of law and all the nonsense that we like to talk about. But we don't ratify treaties about, I don't know, defending humans. We conspicuously avoid that. We actually have a great track record of advocating for human rights and then denying them when it comes to actually being part of the international community, which is a slightly problematic thing. But let's get something very clear. When the CDC in April of 2003 filed the patent on SARS coronavirus isolated from humans, what did they do? They downloaded a sequence from China and filed a patent on it in the United States. Any of you familiar with biological and chemical weapons treaties knows that's a violation. That's a crime. That's not an innocent oops. That's a crime. And the United States Patent Office went as far as to reject that patent application on two occasions until the CDC decided to bribe the Patent Office to override the patent examiner to ultimately issue the patent in 2007 on SARS coronavirus. But let's not let that get away from us, because it turns out that the RT-PCR, which was the test that we allegedly were going to use to identify the risks associated with coronavirus, was actually identified as a bioterrorism threat by me in the European Union-sponsored events in 2002 and 2003, 20 years ago. That happened here in Brussels and across Europe.
And that's our program for today. Hope you all enjoyed it and found something that challenges your pre-existing biases and beliefs, because, look, the majority of Americans got their vaccines, multiple vaccines, and now we're finding out from Edward Dowd and his group of PhDs that by looking at insurance actuaries, where people are paid when they die, that there is anywhere from a 20% increase in death with no known cause in people who should be in the peak of life, 19 to 60 years of age, working people. Well, and it could be as high as 40% in the general population. Well, that's not good. No, when you consider that more or less around 1.8 million Americans die each year, and you have anywhere from a 20 to 40% increase in the last 2 years in those numbers, and the only thing that's different is vaccines. Well, then shouldn't we be paying attention? Yes, we should. But that means then the government used us as human guinea pigs and don't want to be held responsible or liable, because then the question is, did you know that your vaccine could be this deadly? And the answer is, yes, they did. And it's in their own papers that they wanted to hide from the public for 75 years. So it's important that we know these facts, even if they upset us, even if they make us angry at the people who betrayed our trust. So you keep trusting the same people who've already lied to you repeatedly, that's on you. But challenge it, all right? I only present information that's fully documented. I want to thank you all for listening. I hope you had a nice day today, and we look forward to being back with our health and nutrition segment on tomorrow's program.
All my